So first of all, we're going to do a calculation in QED. So we're going to need QED rules. So I'm just going to put them up here to remind you. It should be no mysteries here, hopefully. Just factors of 2 pi that might be different than you're used to. So this is just the vertex, Q is a charge, so in this case, the electron charge is Q is equal to minus E. That's the one we're going to be using, so this minus sign won't be there in the calculation we're doing. I hate those boards. We're not going to actually use the photon propagator for anything. I'll just put it down there for some use.
So alpha is a parameter that depends on your gauge?
So just I don't remember what you call it. This. Hoft gauge or something? So alpha is just a real parameter that it fixes the gauge. It's like, I think in your Lagrangian it comes in like something of this form, I think, but I haven't actually checked. That's what it was in the last lecture notes I did, but in the lecture notes of Cliff, I'm not entirely sure because I couldn't find it anywhere. But that's what's normally, you add this term to Lagrangian as a gauge fixing, and alpha can be anything, any real parameter, basically. So, the question mark there, just in case. Don't take my word for this, but that's what I've commonly seen done. So, it's basically to remove the gauge degree of freedom. And so our results shouldn't care about alpha at all. Wait, this clearly must be something else because it's got alpha mu. So it's probably something along the lines of alpha mu a mu squared or something like that to remove the gauge freedom. So I'm not entirely sure what the gauge fixing parameter is in this case. But did you guys get Cliff's lecture notes? No? Okay. All right, for now, it's a gauge fixing parameter, so things shouldn't depend on it. And we're not going to do anything with the photon propagator anyway, so it doesn't really matter for us what it is in this case. So if you're going to need it later, then you can ask Cliff when he's back. Basically, the calculation we're going to do is the vacuum polarization, which is the self-energy of the photon. So the diagram we're going to be mainly concerned about is this diagram, which we're going to calculate. But we're going to calculate it without calculating two photon propagators. So this is basically the correction to the original photon propagator. It can be written in an expansion of basically and this represents this diagram, and the thing we're going to calculate is only this pi over here, which is basically this loop, and not the external propagator, propagators. Okay, so first thing we're going to do is to estimate the order of magnitude of what this contribution should look like. So we're not going to do the loop yet, just going to do the factors of 2 pi and things like that, because they turn out to be relevant. Right, so we're going to do it slightly more general than in QED, but we can apply it. We're going to apply it to QED to get basically what the loop counting parameter is. Right, so write down a couple of definitions so you know what I'm talking about, hopefully. So we're going to basically estimate the size of any diagrams that has E external lines, I internal lines, L loops, and V vertices. So basically, all the integrals, so for every loop, we need to do an integral. So the integrals we're going to basically estimate as two pi squared, which is basically the volume of a sphere in four dimensions, times k cubed dk, which is going to be what all the integrals look like. We're just going to pretend they're all spherical, because it's just going to be an estimate. So you can see over there, the all the propagators come with basically a factor of 1 over 2 pi to the fourth. So 2 pi. Yeah. So any diagram will basically factor this per internal line. Every loop comes with this factor over here from the integral.
What is the symbol that you've drawn there, in that equation at the bottom?
Here? Oh, we replace integrals by this. So every integral is just 2 pi squared k cubed. And every vertex for QED is the factor of E times the factor of 2 pi to the fourth. Times so this is the thing that we're going to calculate later on, but this is just to estimate the order of magnitude of any graph. And if you have it's a great graphs planar, so anything that you can properly draw on the board. You have the identity number of loops, so you include the internal lines minus the external lines plus one. Are you all familiar with this identity or not? No opinions? Okay. Basically, it's relatively easy to see because for a if you have a tree graph without any loops, then you can basically see it by if you have something like this, say, then the every internal line ends basically on two vertices. So if you add anything else to it, you still have, you add one, one line becomes internal, you add one vertex. So if you add more to a tree graph, this remains true. Now if you basically add an internal line that creates a loop, then you add one here, but you don't add a vertex, but you add one on this side. So this this formula, if it's true for a tree graph, for tree graphs, is also true for loop graphs. And so basically you can simply see it's true for the simplest graph, which is this. And then after that, if anything you change to it, it's still true. So it has to be true for any planar graph. The other identity we're going to be using is that every vertex has lines coming out of it, basically. So every internal line ends in two vertices, and every external line ends in one vertex, because the other end is external. So if you sum over the number of ends, then you get this, and if you sum over the number of ends in each vertex, you get this. So we can, so in case of QED, there's basically just one side, one type of vertex. So this is basically the vertex has three things coming out, so that's basically 3V, three times the number of vertices. So we can basically use this to eliminate I and V by writing this. And that means that this master formula over here becomes So from this, we can basically see that L, the number of loops, is what's controlling basically the expansion that we're doing in a small number. In this case, e squared over 8 pi squared. And what's important to note here is that it matters that those that we keep track of the pi's and things like that, because basically this number over here is about 1.16 times 10 to the minus 3. So one part in 1,000. So the 8 pi squared, that's about close to 100. So if you're not keeping track of the 8 pi squared, for instance, then your expansion converges really, really slowly. Whereas this way, it's, if you calculate something up to one loop, you're pretty good to go. And of course, higher loop effects matter, but they're like suppressed by about 1 in 1,000, so that's pretty good. Okay. Right, I have to skip to a different part of the notes, so 1 second. So if there's any questions or problems, feel free to interrupt me and ask at any time. All right, so now we're going to turn to basically calculating what this diagram is. Oh, is my writing legible on the board? Or do I need to write bigger, or? It's good? Right, so I'm basically going to just write down what this integral is, and then if there's any problems with that, feel free to ask. The only problem is probably going to just show up in what the factors of 2 pi are like, and that just depends on conventions. So you can talk about it if you want to, but it's probably easiest to just go factor your notes what the factors of 2 pi are. Write down actually what the momenta are here. So Q is basically the momentum of the photon, and then we take P and P minus Q for the two momenta of the fermion. Are you happy with this formula? So S is basically this thing over here in the bracket is S P. It's just a shorthand for this matrix. So anybody unhappy with this formula over here?
So S is the S matrix.
Sorry?
S is the S matrix.
Oh, no. Sorry, that's just terrible use of notations, I suppose, but S is simply the vertex, the matrix part of the propagator over there. So this thing in square brackets here, that's just a matrix in spin space, just for shorthand is written as S. So this thing over here this thing and this thing are matrices in spin space, just like the gammas are. So this whole thing is basically some combination of gamma matrices, one big matrix, and then you take the trace over it. So the reason you trace over it is because basically you're going around the loop. So you start here with basically m comes n comes p comes q, but you have to set q and m together at this point again. So that's why you have to trace. So you have a matrix and then you have the only the diagonal components.
But in that formula, you have a 2 pi squared raised to the power n.
Sorry?
You have a 2 pi squared raised to the power n.
Here.
Yeah, where does this appear in this
formula?
Because you have the 2 pi 4.
So this 2 pi squared comes from the integral, right? So this is because we estimated the integral by 2 pi squared k cubed dk. So that's for every loop integral that you're doing, you get one of those factors of 2 pi squared. But here, we haven't done the integral yet, right? So once we use, so this integral is basically, it's the integral of, what's the variable here? P, I suppose. So d4p. So this is approximately equal to the absolute value of the absolute value of p here times p cubed times this 2 pi squared. So in this integral, that's where this vector 2 pi t is. But we're going to do the integral exactly. So this is just an order of magnitude estimate. We're just now going to try to find out what it actually is. Those are absolutely useless. Okay.
Sorry, I can't read the top part of the board now.
Yeah, I know. I'm just going to write another line and I'm going to put this one down.
Okay.
So it's basically it's this integral that we're going to be calculating. Okay, and you can already see it's going to be basically divergent because each of those propagators have a p on top, p squared on the bottom, so they're 1 over p. So this whole part is going to go like 1 over p squared. And this integral is p cubed dp, so it's integral of p dp, which is clearly divergent. So we need to do something about that. Okay. first thing we're going to be doing is to rewrite this integral, because it's a lot easier if you make this an even function of t. So that basically combined that this time term and this term appear in the same way. This is called Feynman reparameterization. And basically, it's the observation that so this observation here. So the reason why this is relevant is here we have a product in the denominator of basically two squares. And we can just call those things A and B and replace it by an integral like this. So so basically, if you work out the bottom here, you get this denominator, which is This term here appears in this integral of d4p, so, right? So we're integrating this. Over momenta. Now, basically, we can make a shift in the integration variable here to absorb this qx into p. So p minus qx would become our new integration variable. And then we have basically simply here square plus something squared. So that simplifies the integral. But what we are doing, which is important to realize, is that we're changing the order of integration in order for this to be useful at all. So we bring the x integral to the outside, is not always well defined. So let's see when you see. So the notes here that some care is necessary, which is not particularly clear when you can do this. But bottom line is, as a physicist, what you just do is you just shift you switch your integration whenever you feel like it. And if you get an answer that's absolutely ridiculous, clearly it wasn't allowed. So you just do it, try it, and if everything works out, then you just claim that you knew all along it was fine. If it doesn't work out, you just don't show your notes to anybody and you try again in a different way. That's basically how you're supposed to deal with those kinds of things. If you're a mathematician, this is where you stop and you'll be like, I'm not allowed to do it. So we're just going to ignore that, we're going to pretend everything's fine. And luckily, this has been tested by other people, so we're going to end up with an answer that's hopefully at least somewhat reasonable. And if you ever do this in your calculation and you come across something that's stupid, it clearly wasn't allowed. The same thing with reparameterizing things can also be done for higher numbers of propagators, so you can simplify again. So the same thing for higher dimensions is. So basically, you introduce n minus 1 of those Feynman parameters, the xn, and basically you have the difference between each of them. And you integrate here, that's important, you integrate to only to the value of the previous x. So you're integrating over a triangle if you have two Feynman parameters and generalizations of that for more. So you can prove this easiest basically by induction. Do you guys want to prove this? Do you want to do it on your own? Or you already know this? OK. Does anybody have an opinion?
I think you can skip it.
OK, good. So before we're going to be using this to this integral over here, we're also going to need to regularize it. So this integral, as I said, is divergent. So we need to define what we exactly mean by this integral before we start manipulating it. Okay. So the idea is that whatever we do to regularize, our answer shouldn't be dependent on how we do it. And this is not trivial, because there's plenty of ways you can take this integral and make it finite that give you answers that do depend on how you do it. One thing that you could imagine to do is, so you've got this d4p, then you just say, well, let's just put in a cutoff scale, right? Then everything's finite because you only integrate over a finite amount of omega. But the problem with this is that this is not Lorentz invariant, because if you change your coordinates, then you're changing which momenta you are including and which you are not including. So that means that the answer that you're getting is going to be dependent on this lambda in some way, and that's in that way it's not a useful answer. And it turns out that if you then do that and you send lambda to infinity after you've regularized, you still end up with a useless answer, because it's you don't recover Lorentz invariant status in that way. So what we want to do is we want to find regularization screens. It's actually clear. So we want to have a regularization scheme which basically preserves the symmetries of the problem, so that we don't, throughout our calculation, implicitly break those symmetries and then just pray it gets restored at the end of the calculation, because usually it doesn't. So let's see. So what we're going to do is something called dimensional regularization. So basically the idea of dimensional regularization is that, where do you have our integral? So this integral is divergent because this goes.
Before you move on, so is it bad only in G, or even if I deal with a scalar?
There may be some theories in which it works, but I think that's mostly restricted to free theories. So the thing is that what you're breaking is not the gauge invariant, right? You're breaking Lorentz invariants. Mm-hmm. So there may be some theories in which you don't actually see that in your final answer, but I kind of doubt it. But I won't go out and say that it's absolutely impossible to find a theory in which it works. But generally, it won't work.
But people do cutoffs, right?
Sure, for order of magnitude estimates.
Okay, but they don't do it. I thought not everyone does dim reg,
From which century are you reading papers? Because if anybody is calculating anything that they want an actual number out of, then they're doing dimensional regularization.
My impression was that it was just easier and more, like, but I thought it was still both fine, just not
with a cutoff. Well, it does break Lorentz invariants,
so it's only
well defined in a certain frame,
yeah.
Right? So, and if you do a calculation that's frame dependent, then you're not guaranteed that it's even true in that frame either, in whatever frame you think is the fundamental frame, right? You need to predefine what your fundamental frame is, and you can't do that in any way that really makes sense. So if you estimate, then it's fine. If you do a calculation where you end up with two things that are proportional to the cutoff, and you take the ratio of them, then you have an answer that doesn't have the cutoff in it, that's fine, right? Then you should get the right answer, but only in those cases. So for some calculations, you should be able to do it. If you end up calculating a ratio of things that doesn't happen to have the cutoff in it. But you can only do that if you have two quantities that both depend in the exact same way on the cutoff. Then you can divide them, for instance, or subtract them and get something that's sensible. But for as far as I know, people just use dimensional regularization because you're guaranteed to get sensible answers. Yeah?
Apparently, depending on your regularization scheme, you're going to get different answers. And so there's
different answers to what?
To your calculation.
Well, what kind of calculation?
Like scattering amplitude.
No.
No.
You're not going to get different answers to physical quantities. And a scattering amplitude is a physical quantity. Right? If you have a regularization, then it can be that there's a dependence on. For instance, the things that which you think talk about, I think, is that you're going to get for instance, electron photon scattering. So an electron sends out a photon on a process like this, then you're going to get some dependence on the charge, on the cutoff, on the momentum at which it happens, right? But those quantities here, this is the bare charge that appears in your Lagrangian. So that's not actually a physical object. So you do an experiment that measures what this E is, but you're not measuring, in that case, a cutoff-dependent quantity. So what you're really measuring is E of lambda for a process. So the physical predictions of the theory are not what this amplitude is or what any other amplitude is. The physical predictions are, once you've measured your E of lambda and you use that E of lambda in a different calculation, then you get a physical prediction. So that is, if once you express, for instance, a different scattering in terms of this scattering, that's what physical answers are. So, and in those answers, the cutoff or whatever your regularization scheme is can never appear, because it's just a regularization scheme. It's a way to calculate something. It doesn't define what the quantities are. So the experiment doesn't care about what your regularization scheme is, right? So, but the thing is that if you have a regularization scheme, generally speaking, you will have some parameters that you cannot determine from the theory. And you have to go out and measure those. And those will, what those quantities look like in your theory depends on your regularization scheme. But once you calculate a physical observable from them, this does not no longer depend on your regularization scheme. So some things are easier than others, but at the end of the day, whenever you measure something, it doesn't matter how you calculate it, that's just an answer. So unless you have the wrong answer, I mean, sure, you could do regularization schemes that don't make sense. And then you're going to get things that depend on your regularization scheme. So if you ever have an answer of a physical quantity that depends on how you regularize things, you have to go back and do it differently, because it doesn't make sense. Because nature doesn't care how you do your calculation. There's just an answer. Right, dimensional regularization. Okay, so the basic observation is that this integral diverges because this goes roughly as p cubed dp times 1 over p squared, right? But if instead of a 4 here, we would have written integral d4 plus dp, then we basically get p to the power, well, I guess I should write a minus here. Notes. So certainly we can choose some d for which this integral converges, right? Because, well, say d equals minus 500, or plus 500 in this case, I guess. That's the minus sign there. This is clearly completely divergent. There's no problem. Now, of course, it's a little weird to think that you'd have an integral over a negative number of dimensions. But in principle, there's nothing wrong with saying this integral. Once you assume it's spherically symmetric, that this integral can have a sensible answer for some value of d, but at least once you're at this point. That's basically the idea that we're exploiting, that there are some d that we can put in for which this integral is finite, and then we can continue from that. Great. Order of the nodes got mixed up. Sorry. Oh. Look for them forever there, of course. Sorry. I just want to use notes so I stick to the same notation that Cliff's using so that next time you're not going to be too confused if he writes other things down. Right, so in order to do dimensional regularization, we're going to replace any four-factor p mu by some n vector. So this is p mu p tilde small m. So small m runs from, so mu equals 0 to 3, and m equals 4 to d minus 1. All those extra components are space-like. So so it's only 0 is the only time-like direction. All the external momenta don't change. They only have the four, only momenta in four directions that you know. And so that basically guarantees that the if you integrate over internal momenta that does have values over here, that you have spherical symmetry. So we can replace. Basically, let me write this. So, and then this part here. We're going to write as a spherical integral times a power. So let me make sure I get the factors right. For this vector over here, that's just the surface area of the sphere in d minus 4 dimensions. So the
surface
unknown,
area.
Sorry.
What?
The surface area. So normally, if you have a three dimensional sphere, you would write the integrals as r squared dr times 4 pi. This is basically the same factor as the 4 pi in that case. Yeah?
You wrote the external momenta is equal to 0.
Sorry?
You wrote that the external momenta is equal to 0. Is that just...
Oh, no. Only the...
The average?
Sorry. Only this part. the dimension that you're adding. So you keep your external momenta just the same as they were, and everything you're adding is just zeros. That's all that means.
So is that factor of q, that is that d minus 6 over 2 or d minus 4 over 2?
Here?
Yes.
6. Because you also have the dq tilde here. So if you add that one, it becomes minus 4, right?
Okay, but why do you divide by 2?
Sorry?
Why do you divide by 2?
Am I missing the joke? Maybe I am messing this up, but let me check if I wrote the right thing here. It does say over 2 by, right here, but it doesn't really make sense, does it? Oh, I see what I did there. Right, so you're right, it's not over 2, but once you're going to be doing the integral, then basically everything only going to be depending on q squared. So we're going to be writing it as integral over q squared, and then this should turn into 2 tilde squared. Right? So that's... So this is probably just a typo in the notes, because this is what you do to simplify later. So if you just write that case is from 0 to infinity. So that's where that comes from. But you're right, this shouldn't be there. So I'm gonna ignore this. Sorry?
Minus 5,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right.
Also, in your integration measure on this board there, you had 1 minus d or 3 minus d.
Sorry?
So in your integral, okay, you have some number, then minus d.
In the lower last.
Here?
Yes.
This 4 minus d.
Yeah.
So you're subtracting dimensions. So what you call d, that's not the same d as what you have up there, right?
I love teaching somebody else's notes. Okay, yeah. So where d is not equal to d. Great.
It's just like a dash.
Not the same d.
Yeah, so d that I wrote here, it's not the same thing as here. So this is coming straight from the notes, so assume it's defined this way. I think the other one also came from the notes, but, right.
Then what is that d equal to?
Sorry?
What is that d then?
So for now, it's a free parameter. So in this case, we want to set d equal to 4 at the end of the calculation, right? Because then all these things that we added disappears. But we have to do that after we regularize everything. So there are some d's for which this integral makes sense. And we can do the calculation for that point. Then we're basically going to define it for all other d's where it a priori doesn't make sense, just to be it's not quite analytic continuation, but something like that. So we're going to define the divergent integral in terms of d by continuing it from the values where it makes sense.
Okay.
But at the end of the calculation, we're going to set d equals to 4 here so that the extra part disappears.
Okay, so if you write m goes from 4 to d minus 1, it means that you're running up from 4 up to d minus 1. And so if d is 4, then m just doesn't exist.
Right, if d is 4, you've not added any extra dimensions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we, at the end of the day, want to have. But we can define this we can define this integral for essentially arbitrary d, where we do this extra part, we do in spherical coordinates, and we can get an answer. We can explicitly do that integral, except for the radial part here. So except for only this integral over here. Oh, I guess I should put extra plus signs around this. And then once we have defined it as a general function, then it could be just simply a function of D that we don't care anymore where it came from. And then so then we define just our answer to the original integral to be the case where we take the limit of D going to zero of that function that's just a zero function of D now. So this procedure, it's the same as what you do if you have a divergent integral in the complex plane. If at some values it doesn't exist, if you have two functions that agree in a certain area in the complex plane, then they agree everywhere if they're analytic. So if you have an integral that's divergent in some parts but not divergent in other parts in the complex plane, then you can define it on the parts where it would be divergent as this is not really the function. It's this other function that agrees with it on this area where it's well defined. Because the fact that the integral is divergent means that it's just ill-defined. So we have no idea a priori what it should be. So we define a class of integrals with arbitrary D, some of which are convergent. And we say all the ones that are not convergent, we just take as a continuation in D and define the integral in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, you mean really that Q could or is zero, not P could or. And I guess you sort of switched P and Q, because here the internal momentum was P and the external momentum was Q.
Right. Yes, so there, I mean, the external momenta have zero. So, yes, you're right. So you only set the external momentum to zero, so that in that diagram, that's the Q. Yeah. So since this is apparently not as consistent as I thought it was, maybe this is a good time to stop. I'll go over and make sure that they have a consistent set of notations for next class, and continue with this. Are you happy with that, or want me to go on and make more mistakes?
More mistakes.
Okay. So I will start with your mark. All right. So Friday, Cliff wasn't sure yet if he was going to be here Friday. So if not, I'm going to do class again. And if he is, then I'll just tell him where we stand. Do you guys know? Do you all get the link of the assignment?
No.
Okay.
Sorry? Cliff sent the email, but there was no link in it.
Oh.
The title was "You Find the Link for the Assignment."
Great. Okay. So I got the assignment as an attachment somewhere. So anybody, if you send me an email, then I'll send you back the assignment. Can you?
Is that a comma with after van?
No, dots.
No.
So leo.van.neuro. If you send me an email, I can send you what the assignment is. If you have a look at it, if there's any questions on Friday, feel free to ask them as well.
Did you say there was course notes available?
No, I just didn't know if there were or not. So, actually, probably not, because we've copied this directly from notes he had for me, so he probably doesn't have a stack of them. So, probably not.